Over the Christmas season this year, I struggled with two states of mind. One was trying to keep the joyful, merry Christmas spirits plastered on my face with a nice wide smile, while the second one I was struggling with. That was the sadness and the anger over the images of war, death, and destruction that assaulted me and you every day on the television, on social media. And here are some of the heartbreaking images that I found crowding my mind. I see the image of a street in Gaza where every building is reduced to rubble. A father runs to find care for the bleeding child in his arms. I'm reminded that this war in Israel and Palestine is a deadly, destructive battle that has already killed 24,000 innocent civilians, and two-thirds of them are children and mothers. I see a child on a street in Ukraine, crying her eyes out, sitting beside the body of her dead mother. And I'm reminded that Russia's brutal war on Ukraine continues every day with deadly results and no signs of ending. Then I see in my mind's eye the image of a doctor telling a brave student and her mother that after all the treatment and drugs and infusion of altered stem cells and occasional small signs of hope and the courageous battle that Jasmina has fought over the past 3 years, the doctor saying to them, the cancer has returned. I got that call from Jasmina's mother last week. This terrible news. Jasmina has been a would-be student at Queen's University in Kingston. She went twice to begin a semester, and within 5 or 6 weeks, her mother had to go back, go to Ontario and bring her home because the cancer would not let her stay. She's a student that we have prayed for over 3 years in Kerrisdale Presbyterian Church, where I belong. I wept as Kelly, her mother, told me that terrible news. I hung up the phone, and forgive me, but I shouted, no, damn it. God, this is a precious child of yours. She and we have cried to you for healing and wholeness for years, but you have been silent. Have you abandoned her? Sorry if I have offended you by speaking to God in such language, but we need to know that that kind of language is to be found in many parts of the Bible, even on the lips of Jesus. We read two Psalms this morning. I doubt if those two Psalms perhaps have ever been read as a text for a sermon in this church or perhaps any other church. I doubt if those two Psalms have been very popular when we read the Psalms for our own devotions. Because in most churches and in most of our individual faith lives, we prefer the other Psalms. We prefer the ones that assure us of God's love and forgiveness, the ones that call us to worship our majestic, all-powerful, marvelous Creator God. Those are wonderful Psalms, and they help us lift our hearts in praise and gratitude. They comfort us in sorrow, and they get us through the rough times. But there are other Psalms that take us to different places. They express the deep, heart-rending cries of a people who get no response. People who are brutally honest with God about what they really want God to do to their enemies. There are prayers in these Psalms that we might never have to pray for ourselves. Some of us might have wanted to pray such prayers, but we think it's not an appropriate way to talk to God. Psalm 88 is an embarrassment to our conventional faith. It is the cry of a believer whose life has gone completely cockeyed. He desperately seeks contact with Yahweh, his God, his partner in the covenant with God's people, but he's unable to get any response whatsoever from God. He is in the darkness of abandonment, and he must stay in that darkness utterly alone. His desperate speech is filled with these words: I cry, I call, I spread out my hands to thee, I pray to thee. But the expected answer from God never comes. The truth of this psalm is that Israel lives in a world where often there is no response, no answer. There is no theological explanation of why God is not answering. The psalm simply reports on how it is to be a partner of Yahweh's in Yahweh's absence. But notice this: the unanswered plea does not silence this speaker. We might think that if God does not answer, there's no point in believing in God. But God's failure to answer does not lead to atheism or rejection of God by this guy. Just the opposite. It leads him to more intense cries. This psalm is fully made up of the notion that Yahweh is there and must be addressed, even if Yahweh never answers. There are no nice words here of playing up to God. There's only anger. The speaker is in the pit, completely cut off from God. He is dying on his way to the grave. And who causes this? This speaker is incredibly audacious. Not only does death come, but God, Yahweh, causes it. He says things like, thou hast put me here in this pit. Thou dost overwhelm me. Thou hast caused all this trouble. The speaker is utterly helpless, and the fault is God's. Finally, the speaker is shunned and in darkness. And the last word in the psalm is darkness. Nothing works, nothing is changed, nothing is resolved. Everything denies life. So what is a psalm like this doing in the Bible? Well, first, because many times life is like that. These poems speak of all of life, not just the good parts. Here, faith faces life as it is. Yes, there are good parts, wonderful parts, but there are also some very bad parts. And the second reason this psalm is in the Bible, I think, is that it is still speech to God. Even at the bottom of the pit, Israel knows that it still has to do with God. It must still address God, even if God refuses to address Israel. One of my favorite Old Testament scholars is a man named Walter Brueggemann. He's from, he's taught all over the world, but from the United Presbyterian Church in the USA. He has a wonderful little book called The Message of the Psalms. If you ever get a hold of it, I recommend it. He says that Psalm 88 shows us what the cross is all about. And I thought, huh? But he said, it is faithfulness in times of complete abandonment. When Jesus cried out, my God, why have you abandoned me? He did not say it with the quiet words of faith. Oh, God, you didn't have to go this far. This hurts, but I know you've got it under control. You'll take care of me. No. Jesus was both fully human and fully divine. So he felt the pain. He felt the abandonment. His suffering was real, and his cry sounded, I am convinced, more like this. My God, why have you abandoned me? And that cry becomes for us the supreme example of faithfulness in the face of abandonment. So friends, Psalm 88 stands as a stark mark of realism for biblical faith. Because there are situations in which it is in which easy, cheap talk of God will take care of you, it'll all come out okay in the end. In these situations, our words must be honest and not claim too much about God's easy solutions. We also read part of Psalm 109. Psalm 109 is very different. It is not about a God who does not answer. It is all about vengeance and vindictiveness against other human beings who have seriously violated the speaker. The Bible tells us that the two greatest commandments are to love God with all our hearts and love our neighbor as ourselves. But in Psalm 88, it's difficult to love a God who refuses to come near and answer. And in Psalm 109, it is difficult to love a neighbor who seems to be beyond love. And Psalm 109 is a big problem for us because it calls for retaliation and vengeance that we do not expect to find in the Bible. What are we to do with such a hate-filled speech? Well, the speaker begins with some faithful speech about God's majesty, God's faithfulness and fidelity, and God's compassion. I'm not sure, but in a way, it seems like this speaker is kind of buttering God up and making it clear that this marvelous God who you are, you're surely going to bring about judgment and vengeance upon the one who has hurt me so much. And then the speaker takes us into a very different world. He breaks into a new, undisciplined song of hate and a wish for vengeance by someone who has suffered deep hurt and humiliation. He has been treated with evil, not good. He has been treated with hatred, not love. The offender has pursued the poor and needy. He has not practiced kindness. He has cursed and did not bless. And this is a critique of some powerful person, probably wealthy, who had a chance to act in a life-giving way, but chose instead to use his chance to serve his own greed and lust for power. He has brought misery, curse, and death upon the people. The speaker had hoped for help and sustenance from his neighbor, but he received the opposite. So he now directs his hope to the avenger, to Yahweh, the one who rescues the needy and punishes the evil. Friends, when we look at what is happening in Palestine, Israel, and in Ukraine and Afghanistan, and in other places of oppression, violence, death, and destruction, it is not difficult for us to point to targets who deserve the vengeance that this speaker is demanding from God. So the big question is, how do we appropriate this psalm into our life of faith? Do we simply ask God to punish the violators with all the vengeance that God can muster and then leave it there? When Putin invaded Ukraine almost 2 years ago, I did not know how to pray for him. First, I prayed that God would change him from a warmonger into a peacemaker. But that seemed impossible even for God. Then I prayed that the leaders who were closest to him would see the evil of this war and its foolishness and arrange a coup that would put Putin out of power. But that too seemed unlikely. So then, as I saw more and more of the heart-rending images of the suffering people of Ukraine, my anger turned into prayers for Putin's punishment and death. In the current war in Palestine, which has already caused the death of over 24,000 innocent civilians, most of whom are children, I remonstrate with God about how to stop it and what he should do to those committing these horrific crimes. But this psalm has taught me other steps that we Christians might take. First, as Bruggeman suggests, it's best to begin with acknowledgement, the reality of vengeance. Some of us will not be keen on vengeance because we live a life of pretty good self-discipline that does not allow us to go over the top with vengeance. For others, life has gone so well that this psalm is just not for them. But for the rest of the people, this psalm deals in realism. With life as it really is, it knows that the evil acts, the unfairness and oppression that drive us to rage, it knows that it is right to carry this rage into the presence of Yahweh, the presence of God who is the majestic, faithful, and compassionate one. But the major teaching here, folks, is that when we bring our rage into God's presence, we have to do two things: submit it and relinquish it. It teaches us that our free, unrestrained speech of rage is given over to our covenant God. We can do that because this God is not a soft, romantic God who only tolerates whatever mistakes we make and forgives easily. No, this God is a God who takes seriously his own rule and a God who will do what needs to be done with such destructive people. When we submit our anger to God, it's not reversible. If God does not do as we had hoped, we can't take our complaint back and then deal with it in our own way. We not only submit our rage to God, we relinquish it. We turn it loose. We put it in God's hands for God's action. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. That means it's not ours. God will avenge in his own way and in his own time. But some of you might well say, this psalm is not for me because I have never been that angry. Okay, but surely this psalm then makes us ask, whose psalm is this? If I'm not able to pray that way today, then who needs to pray that way today? It could be those in Ukraine whose daily grief and loss are way too much to bear. It could be those 2 million people in Gaza who have been driven from their homes, who have lost loved ones, who have been denied food, medicines, water, and power. Could they not be praying that way today? Or maybe those unhoused ones freezing on the streets of Canada, or those parents whose child has just been told that their cancer has come back. Through this psalm, we who take God seriously may join in the prayers of those whose burden is just too much to bear alone. For such as these, their rage must be carried to the very court of heaven. Love of neighbor surely means that we go to the court of heaven with the neighbor who has been grieved. our prayer life is selfish if it deals only with our own needs and wishes. We are invited to join in such prayers for and with others, to help them to declare and submit and relinquish their rage to God, even if the psalm does not relate to our own lives. We need to pray such prayers until the full order of God's kingdom comes among us. In the meantime, perhaps we might join the prayer of the ancient prophet who rushed out of his house and raised his fist to heaven and cried out to God, "Oh, that you would rip open the heavens and come down, so that the nations might tremble at your presence." May we be blessed with the courage to pray such honest prayers to God, whether for ourselves, if necessary, or for our neighbors who need us to stand with them when they cry out their desperate and rage-filled prayers to the court of heaven. Amen, and all honor, glory, majesty, and power be to God our Creator.